Welcome to another edition in the series of Discovering Virginia on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean. The Virginia Historical Society has as its mission connecting people to America's past through the unparalleled story of Virginia. And by collecting, preserving, and interpreting the Commonwealth's history, the Virginia Historical Society links past with present and inspires future generations. Dr. Laurinette Lee is the founding curator of African American history at the Virginia Historical Society. Tell us, what is in the collection?
Hello, Lou, and please call me Laurinette. We have so much in our collections. We have over 8.5 million processed collections, and that is those pieces that have gone through the accessioning and cataloging and analytics. And then we have a large number of unprocessed collections that have come in and we have not had the opportunity to catalog and assess them yet, but we're getting to it.
It begs the question of, where do you store it?
That is why we are continuing the expansion process. We need storage, and we have quite a bit of space dedicated just to storage. And much of that is on the upper levels of the building.
Tell us about some of the specific exhibits that, or not, if they're not exhibits yet, some of the things that you are curating and collecting.
Oh, we collect everything that pertains to Virginia history. We were founded in 1831, primarily by elite white families. And so we have a lot of those records. In the 20th century, we began branching out to include all of Virginia's history. And so as curator of African American history, I am in part responsible for new acquisitions, and I go out into the community and encourage people not only to come to the Historical Society to visit, but also consider donating or gifting their objects, collections to us.
Do you think that some people might have in their closets or attics things that they say, well, it's not very important, but might be very important?
Yes, we know that there are people out there that say, oh, who wants this, or why is this important? That's why you call us. We really are dedicated to preserving Virginia's history. And people oftentimes have things in their attics or under their beds that are not in ideal conditions. The heat, the humidity, dampness, all of that affects paper and objects. It's better that it's in a museum environment where the climate is controlled, where there's the opportunity for researchers and the general public to be able to enjoy and appreciate these pieces of our history.
And put it within its place in history.
Yes. We contextualize these objects so that people understand why it is important in this particular time or place. What does it mean in the larger narrative of Virginia and the nation's history, as well as the world's history?
Well, I know you have quite a collection of Oliver Hill's artifacts.
We were so fortunate to be able to add to our collections with quite a few pieces that his son, Oliver Hill Jr., gifted to us. And it really comes at a time when we're able to talk about Virginia history in a more expanded way.
He was a pioneer, and many people who are listening may have been around when he was around.
Yes, yes. He lived to be 100 years old, just died in 2007, and did so much as an attorney in the civil rights movement. And so, if you'd like, I could talk about some
Please
of the things we have. One of them is a lapel pin commemorating the Brown versus Board of Education case, which was decided in 1954. And this pen really speaks to the inequality in the schools at the time that Oliver Hill and his cohorts were on the scene. And the Davis versus School Board of Prince Edward County was one of the five cases in the Brown versus Board of Education. And we know of the Davis versus school board and Brown versus education through Farmville, the incident when the schools were closed there, and Barbara Johns, a 16-year-old student, galvanized the students to walk out in protest because of the unequal conditions that they had to endure. So when Oliver Hill and the attorneys went to speak with them, the students initially just wanted better facilities, and the lawyers encouraged them to press for integration into the larger public school system. So this pen, the Brown Board versus Board of Education pen, really speaks to the story in Virginia a great deal. We also have items from the Army when he joined. It's an Army collar pen, and he served in the Army during World War II. Initially, he applied for a commission in the U.S. Navy. That was denied, and he was drafted into the Army in 1943, and he served in an engineering unit in Europe. He believes that he was drafted because he was targeted because of the civil rights work that he was doing. And as an attorney, he met with quite a few people and pressed hard for equality. He made sure that the teachers were paid fairly. Black and white teachers were not paid equally at all. School facilities were not equal in any way. And so he was one of those who was right on the front lines of the civil rights movement.
Not only is there this history of the civil rights movement personified by Oliver Hill, but you have enough of his personal effects.
Yes.
And that makes him a live person rather than something in the history books.
Yes.
Or in addition to.
Very much so. Very much so. When we reopen the Virginia Historical Society later this year, we will have some of his collection in the exhibit itself. A jacket that he wore, a kufi, which is the headpiece, a cane as well, and probably a pair of glasses as well. And so we're very fortunate to be able to have these things. And in addition, we'd already had a bust that was done by Paul DeSquale. And this helps to round out the story of a man's life through material culture.
Any other things that you have collected of his?
We actually have a memo outlining the fees for services in Davis versus School Board of Prince Edward County. And we have, so many, a cardinal lapel pin and a Virginia state seal pin. He was very involved in the legal work of the civil rights movement, but he also was one of those that gave encouragement personally. He was very involved in his church, and encouraged young people wherever possible to get an education and to learn as much as they could. He believed firmly that education would be one of the tools that would help level the playing field.
He was getting awards, these pins, these recognitions, and yet they had to be very dearly won. People, they came from people who would not really want to recognize this man.
Oh, yes, yes. It's sad to say that he had quite a bit of opposition, but he pressed on. We have a medal engraved with the image of Charles Hamilton Houston, and this was the Harvard Law School pen. We know that Oliver Hill went to Howard University, and at that time there were very, very few places that black students could go to get higher education in Virginia. The University of Virginia was closed to them. And so Howard created this think tank of black legal students who worked under Charles Hamilton Houston. And the work that they did really helped to push the civil rights movement forward.
You also have some other things other than Dr. Hill. I notice in the studio you brought a picture of a helmet from the Knights of Pythias.
Yes,
the significance, please.
I am so delighted that we were fortunate to have this gifted to us. It comes to us from Mrs. Carolyn Brown, who is a retired teacher in the school system. Her grandfather was Edward Anderson Washington, and this helmet belonged to him. The Knights of Pythias was a secret fraternal order, and it was similar to the Masons and the Odd Fellows, but different. It was the first Pythian Lodge was founded by white men in Washington, D.C., near the end of the Civil War, 1864. They were not allowed to join, and so they created their own. And they really believed very strongly in helping the community. The Black Knights belonged to the Knights of Pythias of North America, South America, Europe, Asia, Africa, and Australia. The White Knights belonged to the Knights of Pythias of the world. It was during a time when everything was separate. And though things are better now, we are able to learn a lot about the history in another time period because of the records that they left. And so the Knights of Pythias was one of the organizations that dominated the economic and social life of Black Richmond. In some years of the organization was led by John Mitchell, the publisher, and it was an organization that was very much involved in the community. They paid out vouchers to widows or widowers. They helped people buy homes, and it was a very strong organization. The membership in the 1900s was fairly small, but it was growing rapidly because of the needs in the community.
When somebody sees this, the helmet, the natural question is, what is it? Which leads to the story you just gave.
Yes, it's one of those kinds of helmets that makes you stop and look and not only observe, but question as well. And it's very regal. And many of the organizations during that time put a great deal of stress on regalia and rituals. And so this helmet really has that feeling of something important and significant. It is being conserved now so that it will be seen in the permanent store of Virginia when we reopen. And we're so pleased to be able to have this because we don't know of any other institution that has this helmet of the Knights of Pythias.
Any other things from the Knights of Pythias that have been perhaps donated?
Not at this point.
But if somebody does, they should contact you.
We are always looking, always looking. When we think about institutions, organizations at the turn of the 20th century, we realize that quite a few people may have something and not know what it is, what to do with it, or what the value is. And so we at the Virginia Historical Society welcome the opportunity to meet with people and hope that they would want to share what they have with the public. Because we do research on each piece that comes to us. We do conservation to each piece that's gifted to us so that when we do exhibit it, we can interpret it in its entirety as much as we know. And as we know, history is always changing. We're always learning something new. And so to have the opportunity to show this helmet is another example of showing something new.
Dr. Laurinette Lee is the founding curator of African American history at the Virginia Historical Society. Laurinette, something dear to your heart and probably something of great value to people listening. You started this database of people. Tell us about this.
Yes. It's the database called Unknown No Longer, a database of Virginia slave names. And because we were founded in 1831 by elite white families, the records came to us. We have a plethora of private family collections. In those collections would be documents that contain the names of enslaved people because they were considered property. And so inventories, lists, receipts, wills, all kinds of documents hold these names. And we had known about the documents before, but we had not ever looked at the documents from the perspective of abstracting those names. And this has become a genealogical tool for people. We started in 2011. We launched in 2011 with 1,500 names. We have over 12,000 in the database now. And we have identified over 160 locations in Virginia and beyond. Virginia was the largest slaveholding state. And that is one reason why a database such as this really has strong meaning, because a lot of people's ancestors came from Virginia. Virginia also exported a lot of enslaved people further south and west. Some of them escaped to the north as well. But many people look to Virginia as a starting point.
Do you have more than first names? Do you have last names?
Yes. And one of the things that this database does is not only abstract the names, but whatever other pertinent information that the slave owner has put into the document. We don't infer anything. We only put in what the slave owner has put in. And so we'll get first names. If he has put in last names, we have those, ages, family relationships, values, how much they were bought for and or sold for, sometimes who they were sold to. And plantation name, of course, which is important, because in oral history, sometimes that's all that people have been told about their family, that they come from a particular plantation or a particular county. So you can get to information that way. Now, this is only 12,000 names out of 8.5 million processed collections. So this is just the beginning. But it's definitely worth a stop as people do their genealogy.
Do people's last names correlate with where they came from or what plantation they were or who owned them?
Sometimes, but not always, because they were moved around so frequently because of the buying and selling and hiring as well. We do know that sometimes slaves came to a plantation already with a name, and they would oftentimes keep that name as they entered freedom rather than take the name of their last slave owner. Sometimes they changed their last names. The record is kind of murky on that, but we have witnessed the many names within the documents with first and last names.
Does the computer help you now?
Oh.
That tool did not exist several years ago.
And that computer is why we were able to do what we do. We also digitize the records so that when you go to the database and you get to it from our website, www.vahistorical.org, you go to collections and resources and pull down to unknown no longer. When you get to that, you will see the way that we've organized it. We've made it as user-friendly as possible. So you don't have to be someone who's steeped in genealogical background research. You could be a family historian, someone who's just starting out. Teachers even can use this as well as students. We wanted to make it as user-friendly to a wide audience as we could.
So it is available online. You
and
do not
free.
Have to come to the Historical Society.
Correct. And free. We were very fortunate to get funding from Dominion when we first launched and did a series of workshops out across the Commonwealth. And we also have put a small tutorial on the website itself so that it can help guide people through it. But it is very easy to use, and we have a message board. So if you are looking for family members, you can leave a note, and we have people responding to the various posts on the message board. So that's something to consider. But that computer made all of this possible.
So this is far more than research in a musty room somewhere. This is available.
Oh, yes. Available to all and, once again, free.
You might say how people can access it. Those who have ability to use a computer.
Yes.
How do they access it?
They access it by going to www.vahistorical.org. I'll repeat that again. www.vahistorical.org. And once you get there to our website, you go down to Collections and Resources, and you'll see Unknown No Longer, a database of Virginia slave names.
Laurinette, I can see you are just enjoying this.
Yes.
Tell me, how did you get interested in this?
Oh, my.
Not just the database, but the entire collection.
Lou, I tell you, it's one of those things that happens in a person's life that you couldn't really plan. I started out at the Virginia Historical Society in 92 as an intern. And I stayed 9 months, and that internship was funded by what was then called Philip Morris. Then went on to UVA to begin and complete my PhD in American history. And I was searching around for something to do other than teaching. You really didn't know too much what there was to do. And so the internship at the Historical Society opened my eyes. And when they were thinking of this position, they thought of me. They did a national search. But I think they realized that it was good to have a homegirl, because I do enjoy going out into the community, meeting people, and I do that quite a bit. And so this website really is just a dream come true in many ways, though difficult, because slavery, the subject of slavery, is a hard subject. And it's not a subject that I studied in my graduate school training. I was more into Reconstruction, the period right after the Civil War. But one of my co-workers, Eileen Parrish, works in the Archives Department at the Historical Society, and she knew of the richness of these records. She spoke with Lee Shepherd, who is Vice President of Collections, and from there it just took off. And I work with my colleague Paige Newman when we go out on the road to do presentations. And so I talk about the history. She talks about the archival part of it. And she knows a lot of techie stuff. So while I talk, she sets up the computer and all of that. And so people are able to actually see the database.
Well, you obviously enjoy meeting people and talking with people. Do you keep your ears open in case somebody says something that you can use?
Always. Ears open always, and willing to go out to meet with people whenever possible. And that is actually how we do learn about a lot of what is out there, what people are interested in learning about. And it gives us some idea of our exhibits, too. What would people be interested in seeing? And so this database is something that people have told me they really appreciate, because it's a starting place for them in many ways.
I mentioned earlier that people listening now may have known Oliver Hill.
Yes.
And may have been around in that era of massive resistance. Do people today have an appreciation of it? Do youngsters coming along have an appreciation of it? Is part of your exhibit to teach them about it?
I think many do, but there could always be more recognition of the achievements and accomplishments of those who have come before us. And I think that's one of the things that museums help do. The field trips that students take really gives them an opportunity to see history from a different perspective outside of the textbook. Material culture tells us so much about a person's life. And for young people who, well, all of us have material culture. But for young people who are so surrounded by material culture now, it helps them to think about, why is this important to me? Why does what I own, this phone, this piece of clothing, what does it mean to me? And then they can think about, what did that piece of clothing mean to that person, such as Oliver Hill? Why did that medal, why did that pen, why did that cane mean so much? What did he do in his life to warrant bringing these things to the Historical Society? So it's a different way to encourage young and old to think about history.
Lauren, and I appreciate your enthusiasm. It's just refreshing. What haven't we talked about? There must be loads more in your collection.
There is so much in our collection. It's like a treasure trove. I thoroughly enjoy the opportunity to bring pieces out so that the public can really get an opportunity to see and learn from it. And the database itself is one of those kinds of projects that when you look at your life, you realize, yeah, I did something here. I really did something. And when you think about all of those people who were enslaved, never knowing that their names would be out there so that their descendants could find them one day, that really touches me.
You said something that made my eyebrows go up. You actually take things from the collection out to people?
No, we don't take things out to people. But taking this database as a presentation out to people. And so when we do a presentation, we will actually walk you through each step to help people become familiar with it. And we'll pull up documents for the area, the geographic area where we're speaking. And it helps people to kind of place themselves in history. And because we have digitized the record, they're able to actually see the handwriting, what I look at every day. And this is what I transcribe, and then it goes through a checks and balances system internally so that before we bring it to the public, it's as accurate as we can make it.
So not only the database that you were talking about, but also are there pictures of these things that you have that they can see on the Internet?
The documents itself?
Not the documents necessarily,
yes.
But things
the
like
pictures. Yes, we have a digital collection on our website as well. So you're able to see many, not nearly 8.5 million pieces, but quite a few pieces of our collection that have been digitized. Because we realize teachers, for example, might want to use them in their classroom. Students would want to learn from them. And it always helps to have a visual image. So yes, there is a digital collection on our website, vahistorical.org.
That is great. Dr. Laurinette Lee is the founding curator of African American History at the Virginia Historical Society. You're listening to Discovering Virginia on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean.